I've enjoyed playing here. It's been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. This is the way golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great. But the enthusiasm of the people has been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath, Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the Sand Belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
G'day and welcome back to Australian Golf Passport. It's Matt Mollica doing the topping and tailing for this episode in lieu of our regular hosting voice, Scott Warren. Really special episode to bring to you today. We had a chat with Greg Chalmers earlier in the month regarding Royal Adelaide, the place where he won his first of two Australian Open titles. We featured a little bit of that during our Royal Adelaide podcast last week. We're going to release the entire Greg Chalmers discussion in full for you today. A fantastic talk with Greg, who was really generous with his time. We cover a whole range of issues in pro golf. We look back at Greg's career and all sorts of other issues related to the game. Sit back and enjoy a great chat from a PGA Tour winner and multiple Australian Open winner, Greg Chalmers. Thanks for joining us, Greg.
Yeah, no worries, mate. Absolute pleasure.
Good reliving the events of 25 years ago. Did some research in the lead up to this, so.
Yeah, it could be challenging for my memory, but I hope you've got more knowledge. You might have more knowledge than I do at the moment.
No, definitely not. You're living in Dallas full time.
Yes, correct. Been here 24 years now in Dallas.
Oh, wow. And two kids?
Two sons, 20 and 17. Off doing their thing in the world at the moment. One's in college, second year of college, and the other one's chasing girls at high school.
Does it kind of rankle a little? I assume that they are American children, as in they sound American. Does it rankle a bit when they speak to you with an American accent and you're like, that's my child?
Nah, let's get used to it now because they're both born here. Yeah. And I've lived here nearly half my life, basically. So it's been home for a long time. It's just interesting. Like when we go home, my oldest, I told him, I said, you know, that American accent can be pretty useful in Australia. and vice versa, though, if you bring an Australian accent over here, that can be pretty useful too. So he's been working on an Australian one, trying to get that sorted out so he can come over here and have a bit of fun.
Either of them golfers?
No, I tried golf with both of them when they were younger, and my youngest has a beautiful swing. Actually, they both had lovely swings. And I never gave them a lesson. I just showed them how to hold it a little bit. And they never really wanted to. I probably did them a disservice, to be honest. I teed it up for a long time when I was a kid. I teed a 7-iron up, then I went to a 5-iron, then I went to a 3-wood. And I didn't do that with my youngest, and I should have, because he didn't see enough success to keep going at it, getting that ball up in the air. And that was, I wish I'd have done different there. But they're off doing other things now. Actually, my youngest does clay shooting.
Right.
Very, very good at it. They have a school team and shooting clays and sporting clays, and it's got a lot of similarities to golf. Actually, it's got some interesting stuff. It's good.
My dad did that a lot, and I've had uncles and a cousin who have done an awful lot of it, and I always have a special interest watching it when it's on during the Olympics. And Australia's historically done quite well in that.
It's bloody amazing. The sporting clay version of it, because obviously there's different versions of clay shooting, like the different disciplines. Sporting clay is, you know, basically, you know, anywhere from 10 to 12 stands, which would be the equivalent of playing 12 golf holes, and the clays that move in all different directions. So like a different hole, basically, if I want to use a golf analogy. It's pretty cool. And the good people at it are unbelievable. They never miss. So... it's fascinating.
What's the handicap would you be at clay shooting?
Oh, 100 million. Like, it's just terrible. Like, it's harder than people think. You know, my son's only been doing it a year, but it's much harder than people think. I've watched the kids train. They train once every week. And then I watch some other adults on the side, and the kids are great. Like, they do really well. And I watch some adults who think they're pretty cool and they can't hit a thing.
Now, Matty mentioned that your achievement at Royal Adelaide 25 years ago, like literally half a lifetime ago, for you? I mean, that must, it must feel like you blinked and got to today.
Yeah, that's don't feel that old, but I'm 50 now. So yeah, it was a long time ago, 1998. And honestly, there's pieces of it that are very clear and other pieces are very fuzzy. I actually watched a little bit of it on YouTube yesterday before we chatted here today, just to refresh my memory on a couple of things. But yeah, really cool sort of moment and a week for me. I probably didn't realize how great it was until I won a second time. Certainly at the time, you're young, you know, I'm only 25. I'd had a great year in Europe. I probably didn't realize the importance of it in terms of as an achievement until later on.
You seemed like you're in disbelief. When I watched that presentation back, you know, you're saying all the names of the people who've won it and you just kind of seem just completely disbelieving that this is your story.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I was very Australian in that you don't get too big for your boots. And so at certain points in my career, it's probably held me back a little bit. Even though it's a great person, it can be a good personality trait. It's not sometimes great for high level achievement. Definitely that played out as what you see there is that it's almost like there's part of me that watches it and goes, dude, it's okay to sort of go, hey, this is awesome. This is pretty good. Like I just did this versus, oh, gee, golly, shucks. How lucky did I get? The fact is I finished 25th on the order of merit in Europe that year. I went to Q school the week before the Australian Open and finished third for US Q school in the final stage. I mean, I played a lot of good golf. I was playing really well that year. And I look back at that and wish I'd have been more appreciative of the journey I was on at the time.
And that had qualified you for the Masters in 2001 eventually, or was it your 99 year on tour that ended up getting you that berth?
It was my 2000 finish at the USPGA, top four get in.
Okay.
Yeah, and I finished fourth in the USPGA. Many thanks to, there was someone who bogeyed the last par five that ended up helping me out. So that was very kind of him.
It was Ole Thabo.
Yeah. And that's right. And I was playing with him and I was like, yeah, that's handy. I didn't realize at the time that top four got in until afterwards. I was like, oh, that's a really good week. And then I found out I get to play in the US Masters in 2001. So that's the one and only time I've been there. Cool to tick that box because not everyone gets to do that.
Yeah. I went on the Monday, Tuesday of 2001, that week that Tiger completed his slam, and I can vividly remember seeing you on the 17th tee at Augusta National on the Tuesday that week.
Yeah, it's
good
very
to
nice.
See, good to see an Aussie. Harking back to your win, though, at Royal Adelaide, you were talking about the way in which to approach it and celebrating the fact that you'd done something really good. Reading down the leaderboard of the people who finished behind you, Appleby Senior, Allenby, Faldo, Pampling, O'Malley, Riley, Davis, Grady, Parry, Couples, Carlos Franco, Greg Turner, some bloke, Norman, down the list behind you, Ogilvy, Ahern. But that is a massive list of scalps to claim in 1 week. It's a huge win.
Yeah, it really is. And look, I think one of the coolest things there when you talk about things like that, you're talking about some of the people that I grew up watching and admiring. Certainly, you know, when you rattle off some of those Australian names, like I'm playing with Peter Senior in the second last group. I've been, you know, a young man watching him on TV for years. I beat, you know, Greg Norman obviously was a hero of mine in terms of who I love to watch play the game and how he went about it. So that's the crazy thing about golf is sometimes you can end up competing against people that you feel like, oh, it was only a few years ago. I was on TV at home sitting in my lounge room watching you do this. But certainly, yeah, it's obviously one of the greater achievements that I've had in the game, winning the Open and fortunate to do it twice. But that first one, I wish I was a little more self aware as I was going through it and possibly could have kicked on even better after that and done some pretty exciting things. But I didn't have that in me at that time.
You had won the Australian Amateur in 93 at Royal Hobart. Had you played in the year prior in 1992? Michael Campbell won that year and that was held at Royal Adelaide.
I did actually. I watched, we went out because the Australian Amateur coincides, it used to be finish just before the Interstate Teams Championship. So every team had sent 8 players from every state to play the amateur and then stay, follow on and play in the Interstate Teams Championship. And Jared Mosley was in the final against Michael Campbell. So we went out to watch Mose play. Mose was actually my roommate sometimes when I played. Two-man teams and teams, whether it's for Australia or Western Australia. So, yeah, we were all in town. We watched that was probably one of my first sort of experiences at that golf course. I hadn't played the South Australian Invitational. Used to be played there as well. I came back later on and won that, I think, the following year after I'd won the amateur. Had a really pretty decent year as an amateur. So I think I came back to Royal Adelaide and won that as well. It's a great golf course, really great golf course. It's got some really iconic holes and some. I haven't been back in a long time, but my memory of the golf course was it was just world class.
Do you have some favourite holes that stick in your memory from Royal Adelaide?
Yes. Always the third, but the third was, you know, a little drivable hole, very narrow green. You know, we used to even lay up sometimes in that. Nowadays, I think everyone would just go for it. But when we played the Open there, I remember it was very heavy rough on the right and very heavy rough on the short left. So if you didn't hit it in a good spot off the tee, you ended up with an almost impossible shot to get it even on the green. 11 was a great hole, just the way it was framed. That second shot, you know, kind of sitting in amongst, there was a bunch of trees over the back. It just looked great, I thought. There's a lot about, and 16, the par 3 comes to mind as well. I love a short par 3 with kind of an upside down bowl green. It was a cool, when it was windy, that target feels and plays very narrow, even though you've only got a short club and it really gets your attention. So, yeah, there's a lot about that golf course that is just absolutely world class. And I think that's why you see it, you know, ranked so highly. And it'd be great if an Open went back there. I think that'd be really cool.
It's been too long since it's been played somewhere other than Sydney or Melbourne. It's probably the job of the Open to travel around the country as well, maybe go back to Hobart, go to WA. It'd be awesome to see it at Royal Adelaide again.
Yeah, they ended up doing that deal to try and, keep diving into the same wells, and state governments were putting a lot of money in New South Wales. And they just thought if they had a, you know, kind of similar deal to the Australian Open Tennis where it's in the same city, the golf's kind of different. It'd be nice. I don't know if it's financially viable, but my altruistic senses sort of kicks in and goes, wouldn't it be nice if we went to, like you said, different states and gave everybody a chance to see their golf course played at a, you know, on a world-class stage event. So, yeah, it'd be cool if it gets the choice, gets the option to do that. That'd be great.
Just a brief stop in the discussion to check in on Angus and Grace Go Golfing and what's happening there in William Street, Paddington. Two little things I'm going to draw attention to today are laser rangefinders that Matt has just taken stock of. $275. Grab these before they disappear. The second thing that I'm going to talk about that Angus and Grace have going at the moment, so a non-apparel ad read, course maps. Matt has some beautiful artwork by our friends at Sandbuilt Studios. He has some course maps of National Moona and of Royal Adelaide. Staring at the Royal Adelaide one as I read this, and it would be a fantastic piece of art to hang on the wall for those of you who love the course that was featured in our most recent episode. These can be in A3 or A1. Lead time on these is 1 to 2 weeks. Contact Matt at Angus and Grace Go Golfing, William Street, Paddington, to get your hands on one of these. Now back to the pod.
You talked about the way in which it was set up during that year you won the Australian Open. My memory was that it was like a scale model of Carnoustie, and it was just incredibly high rough, fairways narrowed. And you shot a 2-under Sunday round to post an even par total to win by one.
Yeah, it was nasty. It was, kind of shin high rough. If you got, it was that, you know, graded rough where it was pretty healthy just off the fairway and they narrowed the fairways in, but the further you went offline, that it got, you know, shin high, wispy, sort of dry brown grass that you had no ball control, even though you might be able to move it. And it got windy. And so I remember Mike Clayton actually said in preparation at the start of the week, he said, you know, even par will probably win this. And I got away to a really hot start on the last day. I got up and down on the first, hold a nice little putt, like 6 feet, I think, for par, feels like. And then I got going. I was three under through six. Hold about a 40 footer on seven, the par three, to get going. And I think that got me. Actually, I think I was two under at the time. I had three birdies and a bogey, is what I remember. But it was, and then just hang on tight, you know, the rest of the day. And I kept thinking that, you know, someone's going to come at it and beat me. But it turns out I had quite a decent sized lead there for a little while. Looking back at it, and a two-shot lead playing the last, and thankfully, you know, Stuart Appleby and Peter Senior had opportunities to make birdie to my bogey, and they slid past the edge of the hole, and I ended up holding the trophy.
And it seems like that era in the late 90s, where whether it was a reaction to, you know, Tiger Woods and equipment, or whether it was a reaction to wanting to be a kind of mini US Open, seemed a very kind of un-Australian setup for Australia's tournament.
Yeah, so we went through a period with some national opens where, you know, they really wanted it to be really just brutal, you know, and the US is famous for that. The US Open is notoriously being set up pretty nasty. And so we had some Australian opens like that. It's kind of gone away from that at certain points because A, it costs a lot of money to, you know, grow grass and douse it with fertilizer and water and that kind of stuff. And B, what it happens is that I'm not sure. It's up to the fans to decide and the people who watch. The goal is to have a great tournament and get the best winner. And sometimes that can still do that, but it may not be as fun to watch for some people, right? Because you don't get the exciting birdies. You don't get any eagles. So we've gone to other venues like, you know, the Lakes in Sydney, you know, where we played and we spend a lot of time playing there. And that's really reliant on how windy it is. If it's not windy, we can actually shoot low scores there. So it's just that era of the 90s, it seemed like, and earlier than that as well, before I was even a pro, it seemed like carnage at Australian Opens was pretty common. And so, yeah, we certainly had one there at Royal Adelaide with Eva Parr winning for sure.
Matty's 10 years older than me, Greg, so he's got a clearer recollection of that tournament in 98 than I do. I was 15. And my recollection, it's funny, I jumped on and looked at that video that's on YouTube that it might be the same one you were referencing watching, the one in which Sandy Roberts asked you in the trophy presentation about your lucky boxer shorts.
I made a rookie error.
Never tell a journo anything.
Yeah. So what happened was, I'll fill in your listeners, I was asked to throw away, like it wasn't even a large like publication. It was just like a small, I think, local thing. Hey, do you have anything, superstition? That's it. I couldn't think of the word. Getting old, honestly. So do you have any superstition? And I said, oh, you know, I've got these lucky boxer shorts. I didn't actually wear them. Like I just said it because it was like, it was a throwaway thing. Yeah, my girlfriend gave me a girlfriend who actually is now my wife and became my wife. But the funny thing was, after I won, obviously, you know, you have do a bit of press, and they came to my house, and this cameraman came to my house, and I had the trophy, and he said, hey, do you mind if we get a picture of you just in your boxer shorts laying with the trophy on the couch? And I'm so thankful I had the balls to sort of go, yeah, that ain't happening. That's not going to happen. So I'm thankful because a picture of me in all my glory and just boxer shorts with the Australian Open trophy isn't what we need to see, I think. it's amazing how they grab onto something. And I was like, oh, that's a good lesson to learn. Keep my mouth shut next time.
So in the two years after that kind of disbelief on the trophy ceremony, you went to the US tour. You finished top 10 at the Players, and then you finished T4 in a major that you referenced, where you improved your position every single day. You went tied 16th after the first day, T9, 5th, and then T4th ultimately. What's your recollection of that ascent from a good year in Europe? Okay, I've got a tour card. I've won the Aussie Open. And then you're top 5 in a major. That's kind of an incremental increase in kind of pressure and intensity.
Yeah. I think that year you're talking to, I finished like 41st in 2000, I think, and it was only my second year in America. I think I finished 41st on the money list here in the States, which is a really nice year. I think the running theme was I never thought I was good enough even when I was. And that's a shame in a way, because there's a point there where the kind of golf I was playing, you just need to keep doing that and not change anything, not do anything. And I think I kept trying to get better and better and better. And it's a trap that players fall into. And you see it in a lot of golfers, where if I think of it like a business, if you've got a really successful business, you don't go and try and rebuild it and do it all differently. You just keep going, keep grinding. You might add little things, but you don't try and rebuild the arc. And I think golfers sometimes, we think that the changes we're going to make are going to get better and better and better. And reality is, you may not. You can actually get worse. And at the time, I definitely look back at that time and look at that level of golf I was playing for a few years there. Like, okay, that's pretty good golf. Like, you didn't need to do much beyond that. And I kept making changes and trying to get better, and I ended up getting actually worse in a way, unfortunately. So I went, a few years after that, I couldn't hit the side of a barn. So it was, it's something I look back on fondly, but also with, I look at that player, and if I was watching, I'd be like, just keep doing that. Stop. Don't worry about anything else. Keep playing that kind of golf, and you don't have to change too much. You're in a pretty good place.
I feel like that's good advice probably for any golfer, whether you're a 12 who'd like to be a 10, or you're a 4 that would like to be a 1, or, a 1 that wants to be a plus 2. It feels like refining who you are is a better path than trying to be somebody completely different.
Yeah, it's almost like, you've got to keep that DNA that made you that good. And I was chatting to a coach recently about it, that is a good friend of mine, and he's been experienced with a lot of coaching. And now that we have so much access to launch monitors and whichever accent you want to use. And he said, yeah, there's so much now where even changes he makes with students, he said, we will actually have to wait and see if this leads to lower scores. He said, we might like that ball flight. We might like that path. We might like the way the person is moving, but does that actually lead to lower scores? And so we won't know that for a bit. It's a really interesting thing about golf. We always seem to think that, this is going to make me better. The reality is sometimes you can make some changes and you don't improve. You actually go the other way. I think the biggest lesson for me, if I was talking to a young kid from Australia, you need to have a little more of the American kid in you when you play the game. You can be as nice as pie off the course, but you need to have a little more mongrel in you when you play the game. You get in between the ropes. You're going to have to have some competitive spirit in you that is hardened and tougher than probably I was as a young man.
Now, despite that assessment of your character and yourself, I want to run through the people that you beat head-to-head to win the trophies you won. You beat Tiger Woods at the 2011 Aussie Open. You beat a late 90s Nick Faldo down the stretch in 98 at Royal Adelaide. You beat peak Adam Scott in his hometown at the Aussie PGA. And you beat an ascendant Gary Woodland to win your first PGA Tour event. So down the stretch against these absolute, like, they're thoroughbred golfers and thoroughbred blokes in terms of build, what is it that you tap into in that where, I get the impression you feel a little bit like you're out of your depth there, but evidently you found something in those challenges that you're able to not shirk from it.
Yeah. No question. There's been a moments in my career where I tap into some competitive, I'm competitive, don't get me wrong, but I tap into some toughness that's needed. There's no question. You can't play this game this long. I guess I'm just trying to phrase it that, there's some, not regret, but just some level of, I want to put my arm around that young man at his peak and make him understand that he's very good at the game and he just needs to keep believing that and doing that and you'll be fine. Yeah, I definitely had, certainly some of those ones you spoke about there in some of those victories, they were days or weeks where I was playing high level golf and any golfer who plays, for a living, if you do it long enough like I have, your good golf is very, very good. Like when you get going good, you're just as good as some of these other people that tend to beat you more often. And so that's definitely what I experienced, certainly in that PGA victory against Adam Scott. You know, I shot 8 under that day. I think it was the lowest score by 3 shots. It was a really windy day. I was actually running 30th before we went out, and sort of backdoored my way into that opportunity. And the other 2 days, the two Australians, it was a 7-hole. Yes, I think it's 7 or 6 holes. 7 holes makes sense. Yeah, yeah. And I joke now with Wade Ormsby because he was in the playoff as well, and he had 6 feet to win it on the second time round, I think, second or first time round. And he didn't make it. And I said, mate, that was your trophy. Just got to make that putt. And and he knows it kind of hurts him. It's definitely sometimes you get in that little zone and you get going in the right direction. Both Australian Opens I've won, I had hot starts to the final day. And both of them, I was close to the lead, but not in the lead. At the Lakes, I was the same. I think I was 2 or 3 under through a handful of holes on the final day and get going great and get in the mix. And sometimes when I got in the mix, I managed to hang in there and do well.
Just a quick break here to check in with our friends at Burnley Brewing, who have, in the last few days, released a really special product that I'm sure a lot of you will be very interested in checking out, Jarala, a native botanical lager. It is something that is really fresh and clean and crisp with a whole range of flavours within these little 375ml cans, loaded with native botanicals that'll give you something that is easy drinking over the warmer summer days and very different to almost every beer out there. Get into Burnley Brewing at 648 Bridge Road, Richmond to check this out and grab it before it disappears.
Now, I'm a big fan of the Golf Subpar podcast that Colt Nose does. A couple of years ago, he had Jordan Spieth on. Yeah. And he asked Jordan Spieth if he had a 10-foot putt for his life, who would he want hitting it? And he thought about it a little while and he said, if the putt went right to left, he wanted Jason Day. If the putt went left to right, he wanted Greg Chalmers.
Mm.
That's a pretty nice little compliment from someone who's pretty good at making mid-length putts himself.
Yeah, it was. And the funny story there was I'm good friends with Brad Faxon. And Fax called me up. He said, hey, do you know much about this podcast, Golf Subpar? And Fax is very, very competitive. And he's a lovely guy. Like, don't get me wrong. I don't want to frame this like Fax is bad. But he called me up and he goes, you're not going to believe it. I thought Jordan was going to say my name. He said your name. And I said, oh, that's funny. And we joked about it. But, yeah, look, I putted very well. And I rode my putter throughout my career. And there was a period there where my best putting was arguably – some of the best in the world at the time. I led strokes gained here twice on the PGA Tour. And if I could have hit the ball a little better, it could have been really, really interesting. But yeah, I was definitely very good at putting throughout my career, and it's been a strength. And yeah, that was nice of Jordan to say that. I don't know if I want to putt for his life, but yeah, left to right at 10 feet. Yeah, I'm a good chance to hit a good putt.
And so you talked a bit earlier about the style of golf you played in your career, the style of golf, you know, that maybe isn't what gets W's now. Although, as Kevin Kisner said, they pay a lot of money for 20th. We saw last year, even at the Open, that a Greg Chalmers style golfer can beat anyone, you know, in the right conditions, given the opportunity. But I worry that the pathway from junior golf to having the opportunity to win the Open, it sort of closed the door a little bit on golfers who play the game, you know, a way that isn't 310 in the air.
Yeah, yeah. Look, you might be right. Like, it's, you're not going to see the future of the game is power. Like, and I've said many times that power, speed, whatever you want to call it, the ability to hit the ball a long way, that has become what used to be an asset to now a necessity. It just has to be part of your skill set. You have to be able to drive the ball long ways. And is that a style of play? And only the people who watch the game will be able to tell us, you know, down the line if that's what they want to see. You know, it's a product of many things. Equipment obviously is a big part of it. It comes to mind because we're capable of doing it with the equipment we have. But the other thing is we're all maximized. We're all at the top of the spectrum of our abilities when it comes to launch angles, the path the clubs move on. You know, good players can move it a degree or two. I mean, I went through a period there. I was, you know, pre-launch monitored, and we first got on them, I was two or three degrees down in contact in club path, angle of attack. And when I was able to train myself over a period of time to make that 2 or 3 degrees up, I'm 15 yards of carry further. Now, I'm not swinging it any faster. I was just changing the engineering and the science of it, and delivered the club differently. And all of a sudden, the ball's going 15 yards further through the air. So that's the piece of it that's going to be hard to reconcile, because I think anything you put in the hands of, you know, young players, they're going to max out on it. And I don't know that everyone's going to get what they want if you love, you know, changing the equipment. I think you're going to find these guys are still going to be very long, and it's not going to be, you know, 1980 again.
No, it seems like the horse is out of the barn and the game's
a little bit.
And the rollback just, you know, pumps the brakes a little bit on what the game is. It's not really going to change anything.
No, and you also have to remember, we it's a TV product at the professional level. And if the tour, if the PGA Tour or any tour you're on, if they want us to reach a par five in two, they can make that happen.
Yeah.
Right? They have conversations and meetings with TV and wind directions and blah, blah, blah. Hey, what do you want to see happen on this hole? And if we want to see eagles, we can make that happen. And it doesn't. And look, I get it. You can say, oh, at least they're hitting this club in there now. But ultimately, I don't think everybody's going to get what they want. Meaning the people who were for the rollback, I don't think they're going to start seeing four irons instead of wedges, and vice versa. The people who are against it, they're going to go, well, it's an adjustment, but it's not that much of an adjustment, I don't think.
I get the feeling it's going to be a very modest adjustment. People were up in arms with the groove rule changes years and years ago. And that, I mean, no one ever talks about that now, and that doesn't seem to have made any difference whatsoever. Hasn't discouraged people from smashing it as far as they can and just leaving themselves wedged from the rough. So,
yeah, and look, and this is the thing. I train at a facility, and it's just one facility here in Dallas that's a speed facility for throwing, hitting, so baseball and golf. And there is lines of young kids coming in there, getting bigger, faster and stronger, and getting educated on how to move better. The testing and the knowledge that is going to be out there, because anytime, particularly as we pour even more money into the sport, which we're seeing announcements recently about that, as money goes into any sport, knowledge goes up. And so the testing and knowledge and the science behind how people are going to move in the future is only going to get better and better and better. And so the idea that we're going to see, you know, a Corey Pavin style play be successful in the future is just, and that might be sad to some people, but it's not the way it is. I think the other piece to this that I think frustration should be directed is, as a governing style, the USGA, they don't do a great job, you know, because anytime to me, when you have to unwind equipment, and that's what the last few changes, it seems, they've made, they allowed it all happen. It happened on their watch. And so they're basically admitting that the environment they created isn't the environment that they wanted. And that's their own fault.
Yeah,
I think there's pretty consistent agreement that they were asleep at the wheel for a fair while. Yeah. Cricket basically sent Dennis Lilly back to the sheds with the aluminium bat and said, get something proper. And you sort of wish that cricket example was what golf followed 20 years ago.
Well, you could talk about, like, swimming was the same. They had suits that were making them more buoyant, and records were going to get blown out of the water, and the swimming body's like, no, not happening. So there's been plenty of bodies who got on things very, very quickly. Golf just wasn't one of them.
No.
Scott, harking back to Royal Adelaide for a sec, Greg, do you remember the equipment you used to win that first Australian Open? Because it was 2 years pre-Pro V1.
Yes, I remember I had a set of Titleist. I think I had Titleist DCIs, or I had... Yeah, probably, I believe Titleist DCIs. I remember my driver was a Titleist 905J, I think. One of the early models of Titleist. And I can't remember the brand name of the shaft. I just know they don't exist anymore. But I remember what it looked like. It looked like it had a like tiger stripes on the shaft. It was a pretty fancy looking thing at the time. But yeah, I do remember most of the stuff. And I think I had a Pro Trage, Titleist Pro Trage 3-wood. Yeah, great 3-wood. Look at it now and I'm like, how did I hit this thing? I still got it in the garage downstairs. But yeah, that's what we had. And, you know, it's just a different. I'm glad I played in that era. I'm glad I got to see what it was like, because once we got rid of all that Balata golf balls and we, you know, started using all the stuff we use now, some of the shots you used to hit were just cool. They were just cool. You know, the low rising long iron, you know, starts low and it's got a ton of spin on it and then climbs and sits. It was just a cool shot to be able to see. And you just don't see that anymore. So I'm glad I got to, you know, start the game with all that kind of stuff. It's because it was a lot of fun.
I got one more to get you out of here on, which is you're bringing a group of Dallas area golfers out to Australia to show them what Australian golf is, ignoring the logistics of moving between cities. If you can show them 5 or 6 courses, what's your itinerary look like?
So I think you'd fly into Sydney first, and you've got to hit New South Wales Golf Club in Sydney. I think you have to see that to kick off. I think some of the holes on that golf course are iconic, and it's great just to, you know, you walk over that hill and see Botany Bay in the background. I think that's, you've got to see that. That'd be a great place, and it's obviously a great city for everyone to travel to from a tourist point. So that'd be cool. But really from a golf purist standpoint, I'm hitting Melbourne and I'm hitting places like Kingston Heath. I mean, you can go to Royal if you want. I love Kingston Heath and Victoria more in a lot of ways. And then I actually haven't played some of the newer stuff. I'm really excited to see what happens at 7 Mile Beach, because I follow Matt Godkin's a good friend of mine, and I follow what they're doing down there and what Clates is doing. I haven't played the other one down in Tassie as well, or the one, is it Fraser Island, or is an island down there I haven't been
King
to?
King Island? Yeah.
King Island. Yeah. Yeah. Some of that looks pretty cool. If you're going to get across to Adelaide, you've obviously got to hit Royal Adelaide, but I love Cooyonga as well. I think Cooyonga is a phenomenal golf course and really enjoyed playing there as a pro. And then as you head across to Perth, Lake Carronup comes to mind. If you want a really funky place, I'd go to Joondalup. You know, if you really want like an American experience, like ladders out of the bunkers and like quarries everywhere, that's got some pretty wild holes on it that are fun for, you know, for someone to see. Yeah, look, there's, as a destination, I said to someone on the other day, you could play the PGA Tour on, you know, a handful of courses in Australia, and they might be the top 5 courses you play on the whole tour, because they're just some high quality stuff and we're blessed to have it. And that you, when people talk about it, that are great players that you see, you know, I saw Rory came out with a comment recently talking about the Australian Open, and it should be part of, you know, world golf traveling schedule if it comes about. And when people talk about the golf course we had, it's not something they're just saying, they actually mean it. And so the players, we talk amongst each other, and everyone has on their bucket list to get down to Australia and play, because our golf courses are world-class and they're very good. I think the other thing I want to touch on, guys, while we're here, it's an affordable game for a lot of people. It's, you know, you have world-class golf. I was a member at a club here that was $200,000 to join and $25,000 a year before you buy a drink, you know, so... I think, and there's a lot of clubs in the Metroplex here where I live, and in America in general, it's a different business model. It's a very elitist sort of country clubby game. And there is some cheaper options, obviously, but it is across the board, a spectrum is quite expensive. So I think, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in Australia, you know, playing a club that doesn't, you know, cost $1,000 a year or whatever it is, grab onto it and hold on tight, because it's very fortunate, I think, to have access to the game on a world-class venue sometimes for not a lot of money.
Yeah. I had one other little question I just wanted to touch on before you head off, Greg, and that was the charity that you're involved with.
Thanks for giving me a chance to rabbit on about it. It's actually my charity. My wife and I started, predominantly my wife started, and I'm kind of the help fundraising arm through golf. But we've been going, I think, 8 years now, nearly 8 years, raised about $1.5 million over that time. It's a small, effective charity basically it's called Maximum Chances. It's named after my oldest son, Max, who's on the autism spectrum, doing very well as a second year college student at the moment, studying economics. Basically, we paid for speech therapy and behavioral therapy in the local Metroplex for people and other therapies, anything to do with helping people with the autism disorder spectrum, whatever phrasing is used for you. It's been very rewarding. It's been a bit of work here and there, but very rewarding. Seen a lot of cool stories of people, you know, for example, saying their first word at the age of 11 through speech therapy that we had funded and things like that. So it's really challenging for families, and we know that. So we wanted to see if we could help ease that burden, as some of the financial burden of cost of therapy. So, yeah, it's been good.
That's brilliant. Okay. Well done.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
And you've got your own golf podcast, Greg. Why don't you give that a plug as well on the way out the door?
Yeah. Oh, no worries. Yeah. No, I listen to podcasts all the time. So I actually have a podcast I've been doing for 2 years called Hack It Out Golf with Mark Crossfield, who's a coach, and Lou Stagner, who's a stat nerd. And we have a bit of fun. It's mainly a game improvement podcast. So if you're looking to, you know, you can go through our catalog, and we did a whole series on breaking 80. We've done some interviews with different players, did an interview with Leishman, and Corey Pavin is in there. We're doing a lot of stuff now at the moment. We just went to the PGA show together. So lots of cool stuff in there. But, you know, I just love listening to people with different perspectives. So I'll be listening to yours from now on. So that's great.
Very kind of you. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.